A Biblical Theory of Romantic Love was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 17, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. The note should go more quickly tonight, so let me just briefly present some ideas, and then we'll get going with our discussion. A biblical theory of romantic love. First thing to recognize, and I won't go into this in detail, but the meaning of the term love is very vague and very ambiguous in the English language, in the Greek language that the New Testament is in the Hebrew language that the Old Testament is in. It's a very vague, ambiguous term. It has a wide range of meaning. We can love everything from moccasins to children to men and women loving each other. To ideas, to philosophers, to philosophies, to we use love just for some kind of positive response to all kinds of different things, and it doesn't even have to be a positive response to something. It can be a commitment. It can even be a moral commitment. You can love people that you don't even like because of the way we use the word love. So that creates a great deal of confusion, and it's very confusing growing up in this romance-saturated culture. What is this?
So romantic.
I love roses. That's pretty good.
I love that.
it gets very confusing in our culture when we're trying to figure out marriage is supposed to be based on love according to the cultural values and cultural assumptions of our culture, is that you marry the person that you're in love with, and as long as you are in love with them, your marriage makes sense. If you're no longer in love with them, your marriage doesn't make sense, according to our cultural values and so on. So it just gets really confusing because you don't even know what it means to love somebody. So how are you going to know whether your marriage makes sense or not if you don't know what it means to love them? So there's a lot to talk about there. But what we're going to focus in on today is what the Greeks called eros, what we tend to call, we usually use a circumlocution to describe eros. We call it falling in love or being in love, typically. It's the kind of love that you fall into or you be in. That's what we're talking about today. I would translate it as a kind of infatuation, and that may be confusing to some of you because you might tend to make a distinction between infatuation and true love. Infatuation is what happens in middle school, in high school maybe, and true love is what happens when you're adults. I would argue that the phenomenon is the same. It can get more mature in its manifestations as you grow up and become an adult, but at heart, in essence, I would argue that the phenomenon is the same phenomenon, and that's what I'm going to talk about. Eros is not, we get the term erotic from the word eros, but that's misleading because eros is not about physical sexuality. Eros is what people call platonic love. Eros is a spiritual thing. It has to do with ideas. It's more noble than mere animal physical desire. So I will define eros. I am defining eros, 3b there. Eros is the very noble feeling, and stress the idea of noble, the very noble feeling that makes me feel like I want nothing else except for her to be happy. Now, I'll define this from the standpoint of a man in love with a woman at this point. I feel like I want nothing else except for her happiness. That's how I feel. I feel like I would do absolutely anything for her, for that woman. I'd even die for her. That's how it feels. If I'm under the throes of Eros, I want nothing. Oh, I already said that. I want nothing but happiness for her. Four, I want to serve the other person for all time. So I feel like I don't want something, I don't want to get something and receive something from her. I want to give her something, my life. I want to share all that I have and all that I am with her. That's what I feel like. I feel a need that for the other person, a need to serve her and make her happy. And I can't be happy myself until I am serving her and making her happy. I feel that longing and that need. I feel like I want nothing more than to be in her presence and gaze upon her. It's a feeling that I don't need anything but her. Don't need to be rich, don't need to be famous. I don't need anything. If I have her, I have everything. I feel like I never want to be parted from her. In fact, and for all time, forever. And in fact, there's a hurt or an ache or a longing, a pain when I'm apart from the other person. Eros feels like I could never possibly feel any other way. I mean, Eros always feels like true love. You know, the love that will never die, the love that will last forever, the love that is permanent, the love that is eternal. The intensity of the feeling is such that it can't possibly fade, it can't possibly disappear and evaporate. The feeling that all of 1 through 8, all of those feelings are everlasting. That's what I'm talking about. That's being in love, that's falling in love. Here's my theory, largely based on simply universal human experience. It seems to me that that experience, that eros, that love, that being in love, is a God-given, I think it's a creation of God, a God-given, organic, not synthetic, drug that creates in me a kind of vision, a state of consciousness, an emotional, psychological experience, a sort of real and true dream of the joy of marital commitment. And the purpose is to open us up to the possibility of that commitment. So if you go back and look at what the feeling feels like, notice how much parallel there is between what the feeling feels like and what the nature of the marriage commitment is when you make the marriage commitment. You are committing yourself to making a moral commitment to your spouse, to respect them, to serve them, to know them, to be theirs, to be loyal to them, to share your whole life with them. All that stuff that you make happen in a marriage because you've made a moral commitment to do that and make that happen, all that stuff feels like what you want to do when you're under the effects of Eros, when you are in love. Is that an accident? You know, I don't think so. I think it's really interesting that what you feel when you are in love feels very much like the sort of thing that you ought to do when you are committed to someone in the marriage relationship. So that's what the fact that it's so coincidental makes me think that this is a God-given, purposeful experience. And the purpose of it is to make us do that thing that would strike us as crazy if we weren't under the effects of the drug. Commit your life forever to another human being? Something has to make that interesting to you. Something has to make that seem desirable. Something has to make that seem like it could actually be a delight. And the fact of the matter is, it is a delight. It is a reward. You know, after many decades of being married now, there's nothing more important in my life than my relationship with my wife and the reward that brings to me. But not because I'm in love with her, not because I have this experience any longer. It's a different kind of joy. But the delight that Eros opened me up to the possibility of is actually a very real delight and very real reward. I think it's designed to be a very compelling feeling, as it is, as you all know or will know. By its very nature, though, it is only a feeling. In and of itself, there's no substance to it until and unless I give it substance by my moral commitment in marriage. What gives it substance is what I do with it. But in and of itself, it's just a bubble, an insubstantial bubble that, left alone, is going to pop and go away and disappear. But it opens up the door of me making a decision. Do I want to commit my life to that woman? Do I want to commit my life to that man and work toward making this a reality? I think it's designed by its very nature to evaporate or to wear off, to die, if you will, which is ironic because it feels like it will never die, but it always does. Because I think God's intention is that it would be replaced by a hardcore moral commitment called marriage. So if I'm right, if that theory is correct, then there are certain ethics that follow from that. The first point would be that it's wrong to base our marriage or the decision to marry on eros. That would be a huge mistake. Because if you base your marriage on eros, that is to say, I'm committed to you as long as I feel in love with you, if that's going to be the basis of your marriage is not going to last very long. Because that feeling is not going to last. That's the problem with eros in our culture, is that one of the great mythologies of our age is the connection between marriage and eros as its actual foundation. That's the Hollywood ideal. You know, you love the person that you are, you marry the person that you are in love with. And with the Hollywood ideal, that it's destined for a disastrous ending in any marriage because it can't last. So marriages and families in our culture are on a very fragile foundation, indeed, if they're founded on the foundation of eros. The other thing that follows is it's wrong to try to prolong eros in the marriage. Now, I don't know how many books you could probably find in a Christian bookstore where the thesis of the book is, or the whole purpose of the book is, how can you prolong eros in marriage, or how can you keep the romance in your marriage, or how can you keep eros alive? They probably won't call it eros. But how can you keep love alive in your marriage? Well, there couldn't be a more wrong-headed thesis out there, because that's not what marriage is all about. It's not keeping the love alive. It's learning to serve one another and be kind to one another and know one another and respect one another and take one another seriously and share your life completely with the other person. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do in marriage, not be in love with each other. And so the very idea that you would seek to prolong being in love is actually a huge distraction from the very purpose of marriage itself, I would argue. Now, understand the distinction I'm making. I'm not saying there is not an emotional component to the relationship between a husband and a wife. I'm not saying it's not delightful. I'm not saying that it's not psychologically and emotionally rewarding. It's all of that. But not with the kind of wild, intense, driving, compelling thing that eros is. It just isn't. It's quieter, it's more subtle, it's more ordinary, it's more mundane, and it's more real. It has substance to it instead of being this wild, insubstantial bubble. So it's wrong to credit, and it's wrong to base the decision as to who to marry on the basis of eros alone. Eros makes us interested, but it doesn't tell us who to marry. It only tells us that marriage might be interesting. So it's wrong to credit eros with more substance than it actually has. Just because I'm in love with somebody doesn't mean there's anything there to act on. It would be interesting to know how many adulterous relationships have happened because two people are married and then that just weird, magical little thing called eros happens to one or the other of them. In a solid relationship with a sound conception of what marriage is, if infatuation, eros, were to happen in that context, the man or the woman would just blow right past it. There's nothing of substance here. There's nothing to act on. There's nothing to consider. This is being with somebody else is unthinkable, so no big deal. And you would just deal with it. But if you think that being in love has substance to it, well then, why not? I'm not in love with my wife or husband. I'm in love with that man or woman. And that's what has substance to it. So I better act on it. And I better do something about that. It's exactly wrong. That couldn't be more misguided and wrongheaded. Whether in an adulterous relationship or before marriage, it's always wrong to use eros as a justification for sexual intimacy. Again, because sexual intimacy is reflective of commitment, not reflective of being in love. So eros is the wrong meaning to give to sexual intimacy. Likewise, then, it's wrong to pursue romantic relationships with the other sex. I think this is a real problem within Christian culture, because Christians tend to think that the only thing that can go wrong in the male-female relationship is to be sexually intimate outside of the marriage relationship. I think it's also wrong to pursue romance outside of the marriage relationship. Not in what I mean by that, by pursuing it, I mean acting on it, forging a relationship on the basis of that. I think eros is of such a nature that it kind of happens to you. You know, you don't really go looking for it necessarily, although some people might, but the Greek myths always had Cupid shooting his arrow and, you know, hitting you with his arrow that made you be in love. There's some real truth to that, that eros hits you out of the blue. You know, you're just going along and you meet someone and you're just completely inexplicably intrigued by them. Well, where'd that come from? I don't know. Cupid shot you. And if you give that enough substance to begin to pursue a relationship with that person on that basis alone, no matter what the nature of the relationship, it's wrong, especially if what you're doing is actually lusting after the eros itself. Eros is a drug. And you can become addicted to that drug. And I think there are whole lives that you could look at, and you'll see that what defines their life is that they were a love addict. They were going from one relationship to the next relationship to the next relationship. As long as they could keep love for somebody alive, that's what they were looking for, is the excitement, the rush, the intensity of that feeling. And they just needed to find someone to keep it, some way to keep it alive. Typically, they will have serial relationships, because in any given relationship, that feeling will fade, and the only thing that can get it back is to go on and have a new relationship. So, it's just as wrong, I think, to lust after gratifying my appetite for eros as it is to lust after gratifying our physical sexual appetite. Just as wrong, ultimately. It seems more noble, and it seems more spiritual, and therefore it seems more right, because it's not physical, it's psycho-emotional, that is, spiritual. And it feels noble rather than dirty. So we get the impression in our culture that love is wonderful, love is good, love is spiritual, love is beautiful, sex is dirty, sex is bad, sex is disgusting, whatever. That's a completely wrong-headed valuation. Both can be perverse, and both can be beautiful. Both can be perverse, and both can be righteous. Okay, so movies, books are not only can sexuality be the physical aspect of sexuality that we're indulging in, but also the romantic, psycho-emotional romantic is another. If we uncritically indulge in them, then we're making a mistake. So if not romantic love, what should marriage be based on? Friendship, respect, a person that you respect as your equal, and that you like, that you're a friend with, but then most importantly, that you're prepared to make a commitment to. And we'll have a whole session devoted to that. So I won't take any more time on that, but there are other things to other bases for marriage other than love. So, your questions, your comments. Let me open it up to the panel first, and then I'll let you have at it. So,
I have a couple things. Oh, yeah, is that good? Okay. I always like to add to the bottom part that he's talking about, where to clarify that what we're talking about is what marriage should be based on, not that there's something noble about not being in love with the person that you marry. So I want to just clarify that having a desire to marry this person is definitely good information about whether or not that's something you might want to do. But what we're trying to clarify is that that isn't the basis on which you make that decision, because you can have that feeling with a lot of different people. But the stuff that you want to look at for deciding about who to marry is friendship, respect, commitment. Does that mean if I have friendship, respect, and commitment with someone I'm not in love with, but they're in love with me, do I think I should do this because that will come later? Maybe, maybe not. I think that's a difficult question, and it's very individual, because it could come later, because that's the kind of thing that Eros is. It's unpredictable. But I think it is right certainly okay to know that a romantic attraction to someone is a part of making the decision, can be a part of making that decision. Does that make sense? This is a clarification.
The first comment first. I mean, ultimately, I really appreciate that this concept of Eros being a very noble feeling. Given that Eros, as Jeff has kind of put it down, is something that is almost, I mean, it does look flawless. It does look unquestionable. Like, it looks valiant and selfless and for all intents and purposes, I mean, at that period of existence, it is that. And so I mean, it's the temperate. It's non-substantial and unsubstantial aspects of Eros that lead it to be unwise. Not that it's inherently wrong. I mean, I'm to give you a little more background. I mean, I met my wife in high school. We were basically, as you would say, high school sweethearts, if we weren't too cynical to use that phrase in front of people. And I spent the next 5 years pursuing her, and with an immensely, you know, with every Eros tipped missile in my arsenal kind of thing. And now we've been married for almost 6 years and gone through very interesting things. I mean, the wonderful thing about Eros is that it has the potential, if there is something wrong about it, is it has the potential of leading you to believe, I mean, it has the potential of self-deceiving you. I mean, like that you're capable of fulfilling these things you want to fulfill. I mean, like, that's the charming part. That's the wonderfulness about Eros, is that you're not actually that noble. Like, you're actually kind of a scumbag. Like, and so, and I'm, when I say yes, you, I'm mostly seeing myself. I mean, I didn't have sex before I got married. I was extremely respectful and loving of my wife. I mean, she had a different view of marriage, in that she didn't want to actually be married to me. And so, and that's not entirely true, but that's how I would characterize it, and I'll continue to characterize it that way. But it was ironic, because, I mean, we were very much two people. One person who was, I mean, everything to me was the Eros, and it wasn't without friendship, and it wasn't without a profound respect. And the respect has been the unwavering part. I mean, like, the respect has been continual. Like, although there have been times I've disrespected her, like, the Jessica, my wife, she possesses. I've never met anyone I've respected more. Like, I've never met anyone who I admire more as a human being, as an existing, morally responsible person. And so, and it's not just that, it's just her very, I'm much more poetic, and that's why Eros plays all sorts of tricks on me. And so, I mean, truly muse-esque qualities. I mean, like brilliant and deep and complicated and jagged when she needs to be. And so she has the full palette of things that would that can inspire someone of my kind of character. And so 5 years of dating this person and pursuing her nobly and seeking, I mean, and not crossing physical lines, not that we were perfect, of course, but not crossing physical lines even for the benefit of that person, like not bringing sex into the relationship, not bringing different things into our relationship for the sake of, I mean, that's how much Eros was used for good, was in wanting what was best for her. I was willing to give her 5 years and I didn't want to walk away. And I was willing to not want to put a physical aspect into our relationship as much as I could handle that. And I was willing to, I mean, and the ironic thing was, I was willing in a sense to act out the very opposite of my nature, which is to be selfish and to be wretched and to want what I want when I want it and to be manipulative and conniving. And sure, whenever you're pursuing a girl, there's conniving. But like, but the ironicness of Eros is that it both made me a better person, but it also had a lot of the potential to deceive me that I was a better person than I actually was, because then you get married to this wonderful person and they stay wonderful. I mean, like, I don't want you to think that a lot of the knife twisting delight of my dating experience with my wife doesn't still, I mean, I still, when she's in a room, she's just the only, I mean, she's just fabulous. Just like a unicorn, like some sort of magical thing that just walks around my house and you know, she's making toast and I'm like, no one's ever made toast like you. And so maybe that's Eros. It might just be the fact that I just really think she's neat. And but the thing that as the Eros fades, it not only takes with it this kind of, I'm always super happy to be around you, it also takes with it this idea that you end up not being that nice a person. Like, this wonderful world you can imagine, it's not just that they don't fulfill it, but you actually turn out to be a pretty big asshole. Like, and so, I've now been married for 6 years. I mean, I have, and looking back, you know, in hindsight, you kind of examine the whole situation. I'm always wondering, going, maybe she was onto something about that whole, I'm not necessarily, like, you know, easy marriage material, because I turn out to be much less valiant, much less, like, you know, Homeric, and you know, like, it turned out that as we've been married for 6 years and the relationship goes through different phases, good phases, bad phases, and you end up waking up next to this person and they're not always happy to see you and you're not always happy to see them. And so in that regards, the Eros is gone. And what I found one of the more destructive aspects of Eros was less, I mean, I was willing, I hung out with Jack. I heard this, like, you know, 6 years ago. So it wasn't that it faded, it destroyed my illusion that I was ever going to feel nice about this person, because I still feel nice about her. She still makes the most amazing toast I've ever seen. Is that my wife?
That's Jessica.
She better not be calling you. She is? Okay. I didn't see her. Cool. So anyway, I'm waving to some girl now, and she's looking at me like... The point is, so she makes the most magical toast still. But the gruesome part of Eros, the part of the thing that I didn't expect, was that for the 5 years of our dating era, I was almost acting out of character and I didn't even know it. Like, ultimately, I turned out to be a wretched person that she ended up getting stuck with. And I'm not saying she's perfect, but it marriage has been part of me waking up to realizing that all those noble things that I thought would be so easy to deliver and I thought I'd be willing to do every day, like all these wonderful aspects of myself that I thought couldn't be swayed and couldn't be changed, and I would never have an affair and I would never do any of these things evil. And I mean, list the things you're afraid of committing when you get married, which is like hitting her or losing your temper and cussing or trying to, like, you know, hit someone else with your car to prove a point to her or something. Like, you think of all the, like, the absolute And we all laugh because I make it sound funny.
But we've all been there.
So, I mean, like, you think about how wretched your soul actually is and how wonderful it is that you convince someone to witness and tolerate the absolute worst of you. And the eros that fades is not just an eros that you think is you're always going to feel neat about them, but the eros that fades is that you come into the absolute gruesome truth that you are capable of anything, like capable of any atrocity. And I mean, you can't betray someone like you can betray your spouse. And that can be done over toast. I mean, like, you can level someone, like, quite effectively in marriage and do it with every intent to do so. And the eros might lead you to believe that you will just be, like, the undying servant of this person, but you will pour hemlock in their coffee every morning. And that's my speech.
Yeah,
there
you go. At least spread it on their toast.
That's right, at least spread it on the toast. Well, she would be making the toast. I'd be making the coffee for her, so. I guess.
Good. Thank you.
I have two questions. Is my gun?
Yes.
Okay. One of them is if you guys, I'm just going to, like, ask them both and you can answer them. But one of them is if you guys can talk more about, like, what the word respect means. Because it seems like a very vague word for me, and it might just be because it's English, but mouth is a word. Like, respecting something, sometimes, like, I don't know, I think of it as being like, oh, you want to stay over there, okay, like, I can respect that. It sounds like I'm okay with that, or like, I'm okay with you. And so, it's kind of vague. And the second question is, and I'm going to have a little hard time, like, knowing how to ask it, but, like, if you're, like, if you don't have any, like, romantic feelings for another person, then would marrying them be, like, but, like, you were very good friends, but you had absolutely no feelings for that person, like, you didn't feel, like, fuzzy when they were around and warm and happy, but, like, would that, like, would that have any way in whether you marry that person or not? Like, I mean, wait, I don't know what the word is. But, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay.
You want to talk about respect?
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Oh, and then, sorry. And Toby, you mentioned respecting your wife, so you should talk about that, too.
And I think your English is better than mine, so stop adding to it. You're actually crazy.
Okay, what I mean by respect, here's probably the biggest test of respect in marriage is that it's hard for a man to respect a woman and for a woman to respect a man because we are so wildly different. And I don't know if you've ever seen a kind of portrayal of a stereotypical chauvinist, male chauvinist, you know, that may be an exaggerated out there out front, but that's the temptation that every man ultimately faces, is this woman is so different than I am, and I'm the standard by which to measure humanity, so she falls way short. I mean, she doesn't think straight, she doesn't see straight, she doesn't ever say what she means, and she doesn't understand English, because when I say something, she thought I insulted her. I mean, it's a perennial universal problem because men can't get it through their thick skulls that you're married to a woman. And what that means is you need to get outside of yourself and come to appreciate and value and understand as best you can how she looks at life and how she experiences life and how she views life and how she views the situation. Because and the issue is to not see her as inferior because she's different than you are, but to see her as another way of being a human being, and you make a study of her. I'm going to learn what it's like to be a human being the other way, vicariously through her. That's the biggest challenge to respect. So what I mean by respect has to do with acknowledging the value of that person in the ultimate scheme of things. They really are not inferior or nothing. That's an important way to be.
Okay, and that's like that's in the same way that you can respect like 15 of your friends, right?
Yeah.
Like it's not like super special.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I don't think it's really fundamentally any different in marriage. It's just that it's more challenging because you're not doing it from a distance. You're having to do it up close where you know them intimately. And so you know their flaws, you know their weaknesses, you know their fears, you know, and like Toby was referring to, you get yourself in a position where if you want to hurt them, you can hurt them bad. Well, respect is not doing that. And that's where you learn that they are too valuable to target. And your second question?
Yeah, your second question about, could you restate it? It was about, whether or not if you didn't feel feelings of being in love with someone, would it work to marry them? Is that kind of?
Yeah, or like did mm-hmm. like the feelings have like no way at all in whether you should marry someone or not?
Right. Right. You could probably answer that different ways. I would answer it that I think it does have something to do with it. But I think what's tricky is that we live in such a saturated place and time that romance is everything. I don't think it's everything in the way that we tend to think it is. I think more that in the context of a friendship that you're describing, where there's respect and friendship, and even friendship commitment, if you will, I think that, and there's, say, no fluttery feelings, but on paper it looks like, you know, we'd make a good match. then I don't know that it would make so much sense to just decide because we look right on paper we should do this. Because, I mean, it's kind of like perhaps that's what an arranged marriage would look like. And it could work. It has worked in history. It can work. But I don't think it's necessarily appropriate in our place and time to take it all the way back to there. But rather to understand the role of romantic love. And even in the context of that friendship that doesn't necessarily have fluttery feelings in it, if I start entertaining that idea, do they come? Is there a possibility for them? I mean, it could be that that could grow. And if that could grow, then it could be a really wise decision to marry that person or have that be the partner that you choose. So I don't think it's irrelevant. But I don't think it's everything. So I guess that's kind of how I would say it. Because otherwise, I mean, I think the wonderful thing about this perspective and the bubble nature of it is that we really kind of need that bubble to want to do this. and it's a good entry into wanting to do this and deciding to do it. Where we make the mistake a lot, I think, is that it's just a good experience. Cut off from any information it's giving me about who to commit to for my life. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I guess where I'm getting confused is that you guys keep saying that the bubble, like, pops and it fades away, so it kind of makes me think, like, well, then why does it even matter in the first place, like, that it's there? Mm-hmm. Like, okay. If it's going to go away, then shouldn't I just be like, oh, I could pretty much marry, like, anyone that I was friends with?
Well, part of the confusion comes into what I'm giving a very specific definition to Eros. Not every positive emotional feeling is Eros. It's like what Toby was describing. You can still be delighted with this person. That's not Eros. That's just being delighted with a person. I mean, that it's a part of respect. It's a part of appreciating them. Just that delight that you get from them being this remarkable human being that they are, that just brings you delight. Well, that doesn't have to go away. That doesn't go away. But I wouldn't make that a part of Eros. Eros is this much more forceful, compelling, wild, just turning your life upside down kind of feeling that drives you. And that's, I think, what does just completely go away. It's not there to stay. Another way of getting at the same point that Ansi's making is that if you simply ask yourself the question, am I willing to commit my life to this person? Then if you answer yes, to whatever extent Eros has been important, it's played its role. It's got you to the point where, yeah, I want to do this. I'm willing to do this. If you can get to that point without it, sure, doesn't matter.
Mathematician.
Yeah.
You, 1 + 1, she married.
Did you want to say anything about what you meant by respect?
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I think respect is something that is good to have, definitely a good concept of it as you go into the marriage with a person. But I also think it's your job to continue to learn not just to respect them, but also to figure out new ways that you that they're worthy of respect. Like, but initially, and I've said this, I've described this scenario before, me and a girl named Jessica Ingalls had a conversation at a kitchen table in Paso Robles, California, and about 2 a.m. And in the course of the conversation, it was one of these classic bio conversations. I don't know if you guys have ever had them, but you sit down across from someone, it's the opposite sex, you vomit your story out, they tell you their story, and you make some surmised, educated guess on what kind of person you're dealing with. Like, you know, so we weren't even in a sense dating at this point, and I was actually in a position where I wasn't intent on looking for a relationship in the sense of the word. And so it was over the course of this conversation as this girl named Jessica Ingalls kind of outlined the different events of her existence and her response to, for lack of a better phrase, God's heavy hand. And what I mean by that is the trauma and the brutality that God has dealt Jessica Ingalls over the course of her life. And as she described those events, and she has a different take on those events than I do because I'm looking at them from the outside, the solutions that she chose, the course of action she chose was I could use the word righteous, but I'm always uncomfortable with Christian terminology, and so righteous would be one. But for lack of a better, they were completely and everything that I wanted in another human being. Like if I was going to be hitched and married to someone and bound to them, she described events in her life where she could have avoided so much suffering by doing the simplest and not even a deception, because everyone in the world was doing it. Like, she grew up charismatic. I mean, the quick example is, my wife grew up charismatic, and she could have spoken in tongues, like, and made it a normal occurrence kind of thing to do. And I'm not saying anything about tongues. I have a lot of, all my friends from, everyone should have one. I'm using mine right now. All my friends from California spoke in tongues. All my friends were charismatic. And so I respect them enough to not have an opinion on that. And so that's not the point. The point is, she knew that if she spoke in tongues, it would not be genuine. Like, she knew that for some reason God didn't give her that gift, and she wasn't willing to fake it to make it in that social world. And she was raised charismatic, so this decision must have been made relatively early in her existence and maintained through the whole of it. And what kind of quality is in a human being that makes them make that decision? And in thinking upon that, that's what I mean by the respect that initially was there. Like, looking at someone and going, I wouldn't even made that decision. I made much weaker decisions in my life. I was the oldest child, and I played football, and I had a cushy, easy upbringing, and my father was relatively sane when I was young, and he actually liked me, and there were just so many easy life, so much aspects of my life that I was spoiled and had an easy go of it. And I'm looking at someone, and she had every instinct and like opportunity to just fake it a little while and you'll make it. And that was just a reoccurring theme, like this concept that she saw value in suffering, and was not afraid to suffer for the sake of what she felt was morally correct. So, and I could make a joke at this point about marrying me as part of that story, but I won't. So the respect that we then find is as we get married, as I watch this person totally other than me do things that have absolutely they're just depressing. Like, when we did the budget the first 2 years of our marriage, she would under-account everything, which doesn't make sense to me, because if we have the money, then it's right there, and we can buy stuff with it. But the respect comes by keeping your eyes open enough to realize that the other person's way right about so much more than you can ever understand. And that their preference, even if it's just a preference, is totally legitimate. Like, those things, I mean, like Jack says, it's inherently hard for someone to understand other. And as that other interacts in front of you, it's amazing to observe that and then see it backed up by reality, for lack of a better phrase. Like, and as you watch, and then you realize that, again, also, and this is the developing new respect for a person, realizing that they have new areas that they're worthy of respect, is when you watch them grow in areas that you know they're weakest. Like, I mean, my faults aren't they're not obscured to my wife. She sees them, and I see her faults. And in our marriage, watching her learn to trust me, despite who she married, which is an absolute fool and a monster at times. Like, when that person continues to accept me, when I know that it's totally, I mean, of her stories also, it's totally opposite her nature to be around someone like me. Like, I'm a male, and I'm loud and obnoxious, and I'm capable of immense cruelty to her. And, I mean, I think this is probably always true, is that women in the course of marriage, when they shine, they shine because they're forgiving in ways I can't understand. Like, they're just, and so there was the old respect that when I met her, she was this person of character, and over the wonderful course of marriage, I mean, you see new aspects of respect flower and bloom in your relationship. And in regards to the feeling thing, I'm convinced the longer you're around them, other people, or specifically your spouse, the more intense you love them. Like, the more, I mean, like, there's a different intensity, and it's kind of like an everyday intensity, but it's still intensity. Like, it's still, I mean, like I said, she makes the best toast, but, like, it means something that they're there. And they provide you a meaning that I don't understand. Like, that's, I mean, Jack always says that when he gives, I've seen Jack do the marriages for each of me and my two other siblings, and Jack always brings up the point that marriage can provide you meaning in a way that you don't understand. And that's so amazingly true. Like, when that other person actually values you more than everybody else in the room and does it over the course of many years, I don't know what else that feeling is. Like, I mean, and it's better than being in love. It's better than any Eros thing. It's like you actually have one person who gets you, and you hopefully get them and can repay them with respecting them as much as... So, talk for a long time again.
No,
I agree. Okay.
Jack, I was wondering if you could... I just wanted to tailgate on what you said about getting to the point of being able to say, I want to commit my life to this person. I remember when you and Christine did Christianity at Work, you guys talked about the difference in your... experience. I mean, you fell hard in love. I mean, you experienced that hurting. You know, you physically hurt when Jody was gone. Christine didn't experience the drug with Larry, and yet she came to a point through their friendship of, I respect this person so much and see so much in this person. This is who I want to marry, and this is who I want to commit my life to. But she never had the powerful drug. So that's kind of difficult to talk about, because if you talk about marriage without a feeling of love, it can sound like an arranged kind of dry commitment, I'm going to do the right thing. Versus, I have been hooked. God has drawn me to this person. I see them and I want to commit my life to them. And it may or may not have that component of the drug. It's more unusual that it wouldn't have it, I think. But I think that she gave a good example of that.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's right. And that's why I said, if you get to that point without it, great. That's not a problem. Not a problem at all, because it's really not, I mean, really she was getting there by a route that actually makes more sense and is more consonant with the nature of marriage itself than I did. I married a couple years ago that were really good friends where the woman was so gamophobic, was so afraid of marriage itself and the commitment itself, that from the engagement to the wedding, she vomited every time she saw him. That was it. That even, and they would come back to me and say, you know, should we really go through with this? And even I wasn't sure. But no, it was interesting when she described her experience afterwards. The minute during the ceremony when he said, I do, everything lifted. It was just all the pressure, all the heaviness lifted, and she was fine. What I suspected was the case, and I ended up being right, is that it wasn't that she didn't like him. It's that she was afraid of the commitment, and he was symbolized everything she was afraid of. So her visceral reaction was to her fear of the commitment, didn't have anything to do with him. Mm-hmm. And that's what I crossed my finger and kept telling her.
Yeah. I would just kind of add on to that there's kind of a trouble, though, that I think is difficult. I think those are really good examples of where it's not essential. And that's a really important reality. And maybe we'll talk about this a different week. I don't remember the schedule enough to know if this fits here or somewhere later. But I think there's an interesting phenomenon with women in particular, that if a man is shot with Eros for them, that they have a certain sense of obligation to that. It's like, if a man is in love with me, I ought to be in love back. And isn't that interesting? Women, would you concur with that? Does that fit? Some. What's that?
I've felt that before.
Yeah, yeah. So men, you can feel it too, right? Yeah. If someone has that feeling toward you, you kind of feel like, well, I should respond with it, or I should reciprocate in some way, or, you know. And I think that's where it gets tricky, to say, well, it's okay that you don't feel that, just marry them. I wouldn't want to say that carte blanche. You know, I would want to be really careful about that and look at the, the specific individuals. So anyway, yeah.
I love you. Get over it. That doesn't happen.
The other thing, and then I'm going to pass the mic, is I was wondering if there's time, if you could talk more about respecting. You've talked a lot about the qualities of respecting someone because they are important and they are valuable, and seeking to know them and understand what is worthy of respect, and also just respecting them because they're God's creature and they deserve you treating them as valuable. But there's also going to be in each of us, and you're going to know it more intimately in a marriage relationship, things that are not worthy of respect that you're going to be privy to in your spouse, and how to be loving and respectful and yet not respect those things that are not worthy of respect. Because lots of times you hear fragile people saying, you can't be caring about me if you're confronting me about this thing. We don't want to be confronted about something, so we call it not loving or not respecting us if someone is mirroring to us something that is unlovely in us. So I wondered if you could talk about that.
Well, certainly within the context of marriage, you learn, you are forced to face into the reality of learning to be merciful and not holding against one another the other person's selfishness, weakness, all the things that are wrong with them. You just don't hold it against them. And so you respect them. I will say from my experience, I'm not sure it works real well in marriage to go into the relationship being brutally honest all the time about your spouse's faults. There may be the time and place when it comes up, but it's so easy to have that be interpreted as personal rejection. Mm-hmm. So in the long run, I find myself being forbearing more than confrontational. And the crucial thing is that whatever it is that I'm forbearing, I don't hold that against my wife or husband. You see what I'm saying? I'm respecting them as they are, as they come to me. Not that I'm blind to their weaknesses, not that I'm oblivious to the fact that there are things about them that are not really worthy of respect. But even though there are aspects of them that may not be worthy of respect, that person is. And so I'm intent on sending that message. And if my being at all critical would jeopardize that message, it's just not worth sending the message. I mean, not worth being critical. It's not worth picking at the bad part. Just one other quick comment. I think it is crucial that we understand that ultimately respect doesn't have to be given. That's a moral choice. Nobody can draw it out of me. If I don't give it, it's not going to be there. So I always need to be ready to give respect. Now, not that, kind of like what Toby was talking about, there are things about the other person that are really, really worthy of respect, and you'd think that that would draw it out of you. But if you don't want to give it, you'll find a way of not giving it. And so you have to develop the character trait of being willing to give respect where respect is due. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
And maybe this isn't this might be a little bit off the topic, but the reality that I have had to face in myself is, I mean, I'm identifying with the monster stuff that Toby was talking about. I mean, I'm a pretty self-centered person when it comes right down to it, and it's pretty easy for me to justify, say I see something that I think needs to be commented on or something like that in my spouse. I can't tell you how many times I have said something only to go back and think, you know, what was really driving me in that situation was, if I could convince her to look at this differently, I wouldn't have to deal with this anymore. You know, I could change it, and then my life would be better if this would go away. And that, I mean, it has happened to me so often in my life. It's come to be a pretty humiliating experience, actually. And it has made me stop and think before I say something. You know, you might want to just kind of think about this for a while as to what is it that's really, what's driving my desire to say something here. Because I think sometimes we as Christians, we sort of get driven by this idea that we have to be pure in the sense that it's like God is somehow going to be upset with me if I don't look down on and point out everything that's not good. You know, if something happened that I didn't think was quite the way it ought to be, that somehow I'm supposed to fix it or say something. And whereas, in fact, I think what I'm supposed to do is be redemptive and loving, and that may mean, more often than not, it may just mean trying to be supportive and help a person get past a tough spot or something like that. So it is easy. And that is tied in, I think, very much with this idea of respect. Many, many years ago when you were talking about this stuff, Jack, I've always remembered you saying that respect is a choice, just like what you were saying here. It's something that I choose to do or not. And I have had many of us here have had this experience, but in those times when I've had the opportunity to talk to people in marriages that were falling apart, one of the things that you can see is that this choice has been made by one or both of the people that they are not going to grant respect anymore, that they're going to point to, I'm an expert on your faults. I say, and I can tell you, that person did this, and that person did this, and they're building up a case for why they don't have to respect them anymore, which kind of leads to the fact, like what you were saying, that ultimately it's this choice to recognize that this is a person who is worthy of my being on their side and caring about what happens to them. And that doesn't mean that I have to approve of what is bad, but it does mean that I'm recognizing that I am called upon to forbear, to forgive, to support, and to be honest about, to not hide their virtues so that I don't have to admit that I need to respect them, which is what starts to happen. So in that sense, respect really is something that is a moral choice. I have to be willing to be honest about myself so that I can be honest about the other person.
Of also that I want forbearance from others as well, and as much mercy and grace as I can get. But when I impact someone and when they see something unlovely about me and they show it to me, either by the fact that they're hurt and they withdraw or they confront me, that I'm not to be thinking that they're not being respectful of me. It's kind of more like, hit me if you see an opening. Yeah, but that's hard. We're protective, and to try to keep moving into that. I missed that. Tell me again what I did, and quit being quite so shocked that even unintentionally I did it. Let alone when I purposely picked up the hemlock and, you know, that is part of love. As well, to have that safety of acknowledging we do this to each other. And again, lots of times we just need to shut up and let it go by. But sometimes, I mean, to have that safety of this is who we are, we're going to mess up and we're going to hurt each other, and that when we need to, we can talk about it, because we don't have this idea that we are people who are capable of not doing that.
Okay, I kind of have one comment about Eros, and that is that I was dating this guy, and we were already pretty close friends when we started dating, and so we both were hit pretty hard with that, and it's really, really, really powerful from my personal experience with it. And I noticed that after we broke up, that it went away. He still had it, an overhang of whatever from it, but I was in it and then I was gone. It just went, bye, I'm gonna leave you now, because you aren't there. And I also kind of have a warning as well with it, is don't get sucked into the belief. At the same time, it's a great thing to be an opening for gay married, but at the same time, when you're in the middle of it, it really can cloud your brain really, really well. So it's really hard to sometimes resist the temptation to go, oh, you're the right one for me or something, and you have to keep reminding yourself, I'm a teenager, I can't possibly make this decision now. So it's really, really difficult sometimes, especially if you both get hit really hard with it.
Hugely difficult, and so important. I really appreciate you underlining that. I think it's why it's so important that we understand it for the power that it has, and that we understand that deciding how we're going to relate to one another in opposite sex relationships is so critical, because it's got to take that into account, that it's a drug. It's not substance. And so how do I get to know someone, even if I am smitten? Then how do I work with pulling myself back into my skin and not basing where we go with our relationship on that feeling right then? So,
I was wondering how, because your definition here of Eros is a noble feeling. I was wondering how fear ties in with this noble feeling, because I've felt at times incredibly fearful that, you know, when I'm in love, that this person's gonna find out who I really am, and they're not gonna love me back. So I mean, that doesn't sound noble to me. So I was just wondering how does fear, and maybe even jealousy, how does that tie in with Eros? Is that Eros, or is that something totally different?
I think both fear and jealousy are different. I think in Eros, in my experience with Eros, I was prepared for the sake of her happiness to let her go. That's the nobility of the feeling of Eros. It would, well, wasn't it? You don't know how noble I am.
It's just funny to hear you talk about it, because you're so smart. Man, you're such a sucker.
Yeah, I am. So there are layers of feelings, and I think the fear comes from, that fear would probably transfer into other relationships as well. That same fear would be there if somebody really got to know me, they really wouldn't like me. That I don't think there's anything unique about the man-woman relationship. We have to confront that reality. Jealousy is different. You know, jealousy is the desire to have the other person. And Eros, I don't think that's Eros. Eros feels like you just want to serve them and have them have their life be happy, no matter what that costs, even if you have to sacrifice for that. So if you really want them to have them, that desire to own them is where the jealousy comes from, I think.
Okay, so, but this is where, this is great. What you said, that's absolutely great. But I think we can get confused with that stuff because the drug of Eros, can be addictive. That is, I want this feeling, and if the other person, that Eros can kind of phase from nobility into desire. I want this thing to continue. I want this, we've all seen kind of that picture of the guy who's stalking a girl while he's declaring his desire to serve her. And obviously there's this incredible selfishness and desire to have what I want that has attached itself to those feelings, which you can interpret as noble and self-sacrificing. So I think they can phase into each other. And what happens is the Eros fuels the jealousy. They're not the same thing, but my desire for that, I'm afraid, well, maybe I'm going to lose this thing that seems so good to me. Now I'm gonna end up losing out on it, and since it is insubstantial, it's not true nobility and self-sacrifice. It is a feeling of attraction to that idea, and so that seems like a good thing. My other desires could easily overpower whatever nobility is in that. So, yeah, it philosophically we can say those are two different things, but in my experience, I think they can get mushed together.
I'm still not sure how fear. I don't feel like you explained how fear, or what is that? If is that Eros, or is that just fear?
I think it's just fear. I just think it's fear.
Well, you're saying it's a fear of rejection, right?
Right.
I mean, you're afraid that the other person is going to. So you have these feelings of attraction to them, and you want to make them this important person in your life and so on. But there is this other side of that, is that I have all those feelings, but I recognize that I am opening myself up to the other person in that. And if they don't respond the same way, then I could get hurt. So I'm afraid of getting hurt, right? I mean, I'm afraid of that my feelings here, which which are attractive feelings and feelings that I would like to be self-sacrificing for this person and make them important and everything, those feelings are there, but my also self-protective feelings are there as well. And the one can kind of... The fact that there is something good here is drawing me into it, but I may be afraid that, of being drawn into it because I'm afraid of what I might experience. Right? I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important to know that that kind of fear is so complex. I mean, it has so much to do with this thing that Eros ennobles us to consider, marriage, this idea of committing to another person. It puts me in the most profoundly vulnerable position I can be in, because it basically, it's me deciding how I'm going to relate to them. They still get to decide how they're going to relate to me, and I don't have any control over that. I mean, that's pretty fearful. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think facing into that recognition that that's the nature of the vulnerability that I think is actually essential in marriage, because it's in that vulnerability that I actually get to be known and have this amazing experience that they're talking about, where even as I'm exposed to this person, they keep staying. And I keep staying as I have them exposed to me. And that's what makes it, I think, such a profound bond. But it also makes it a very frightening thing to enter into, and continually frightening in terms of working out the relationship day after day and week after week, because I'm exposing such a naked part of myself to this person. And most of us have exposed those naked parts to people and had them not be very well tended. And so we have a really very real basis for fear. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We have a lot of beliefs and emotional, a lot of emotional beliefs that come into that process that tell us, you know, when I'm vulnerable, this is what happens. And so if I have any kind of, if this person responds to me in a particular way, God forbid they remind me of my father, for example, that was not very nice to me at times, then I'm going to react out of this whole backlog of interpretive grid and understanding that reads whatever this person does through this grid, and I'm going to have to work with that. I'm going to have to decide, is that, you know, and work that out, kind of like what Gabe is saying. We're going to have to talk about it and come to understand each other and do this process of getting down to, oh, okay, you are a different person than that, and maybe I can trust you. And so trust, I think, comes slowly, and especially for people who have been wounded. So I think it's a very complex process. So.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just... I guess
maybe more than you wanted, but
yeah. I guess maybe like what I'm trying to get at is how to act out Eros in a responsible way instead of just, you know, this noble just giving of everything. I guess is that?
Well, you keep going. I'll keep going. Okay.
I didn't understand.
Okay, see if I understand it. Are you saying knowing that if this is an arrow that I get swung with and it's a drug, then how in the world do I decide whether or not it's appropriate that I move toward this person and be self-sacrificial and noble and lay down my earthly treasures before her feet?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm just working from the handout here. I don't see anything like telling me, you know, how to work with Eros responsibly. You know,
right?
There's no guideline.
Yeah, don't drive. And we are actually going to unfold that more.
To touch just ever so briefly on fear, because I think it's interesting. We associate Eros with the poet, with this kind of fearless Cyrano de Bergerac kind of character who can, you know, fling himself, you know, against the dragon and not care. And the funny dynamic in the 5 years of dating that me and Jessica had was that the whole time while my heiress was writing poetry and you know, declaring such profound vows that were somewhat based in reality, based, you know, some days and other days were just crazy. Like the same time this Eros was just driving me on, like, and when I would sit back and look at her, I didn't see any Eros in her, but like, it was the Eros in her that let me love her. Like, because she was approaching it from a much more hesitant perspective. She was probably maybe much more like Christine Barber. Like she wasn't looking at me thinking, this is Prince Charming. She was looking at me like, with a sense of realism, going, you know, this person is are we going to be able to eat if we get married? Like, I mean, and that's not an abnormal joke, but that's actually a really good thing to be thinking about. I mean, like, how is this person going to provide? How is this person going to act? Is this person going to be responsible? I mean, in short, is this person a student of life in a way that they're going to learn me and learn what I need out of life and learn what I need, even if it's not what they need? Like, I'm kind of, she refers to me these days as a bohemian, in that she really realizes that if we had a house or not, it wouldn't be a big deal to me. Like, I mean, I just need a few pads of paper and I don't mind eating out of a dumpster if I have to. And she's kind of like, I don't want to eat out of a dumpster. So, like, I mean, the Eros she had in our dating relationship.
She's so narrow.
I know. She's about to love. But the Eros that she had was one that was combating her fear and her insecurities. But it came out in that she let me love her. She didn't just chase me away. She said, all right, fine. Like, if you really feel this way, I'm going to give you 5 years to prove it. And in a sense, like, the fact that I even had a chance to get to know her was in a sense Eros working. But it was working in a whole different, like, grid, like Nancy said. Like I had an Eros that was fearless, and she had an Eros that was dialoguing with, for lack of a better phrase, I mean, a lot of ways, with real life, with is this person going to be faithful to me? Is this person going to be able to make any money at all, ever? Like, is this person going to be a decent father? Is this person going to be okay if I don't want to have kids? Like, I mean, she was, I mean, I think, she, I mean, again, and this is one of those areas that when we were dating, I didn't respect her for. I was like, why don't you like me like I like you? But like, as I've gotten older and I've been married to her, I realize that she's a genius. Like, she's always kept something in check that I don't even think to keep in. I mean, I'm, you know, writing poems about death, and she's just going, you know, you're going to die when you're going to die, okay? Like, she's just like, and she's like, yeah, so it's like this thing that I didn't even respect her for when we were dating, I've learned that is actually this gift she brings with our marriage, and I learned to be responsible in a way and be a little less fruity. Like, and so the whole time she was dialoguing with what you're describing. She was dialoguing with fear and insecurity and with reality in a lot of logistical areas.
Right. Well, I don't know. I guess I can see, like, in you, like, from what you describe as, you know, this poetic thing and this Eros, and for 5 years, like, that's great.
Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, for me, like, I did that, mm-hmm. and, like, she ended up marrying someone else.
Yeah.
So it's like,
damn!
Yeah! So it's like now, you know, like, when you feel that again, it's like, well, you know, I'm kind of scared, you know, to, like, write all these poems and, like, them, like, mean nothing.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
more.
I was going to say, it sounds more like your question is, what do I do with it now before I know whether or not this is a person who's going to reciprocate or who I can commit my life to? If I get hit with this drug, what does it look like to respond well to that? Is that kind of more what you're getting at?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think we'll hopefully unfold that a little bit more over time. We're almost out of time tonight. But I think that one small just kind of tidbit is that knowing, recognizing that it's such a powerful force, that it's information more about myself than necessarily about the other person or about a possible relationship. It's telling me about a need that I have. It's a legitimate need. But it could be that it's more powerfully about me, and I have to work with, so what am I going to do with that? And it doesn't negate that I might have this other person in my sights that is very interesting to me. But I'm going to be really cautious about how I go forward toward that goal. So that's a kind of a snippet. But
if you're lucky, it'll be like my wife. We were driving down, and she said, if somebody like you ever asked me to marry them, I'd say yes. And she swears to this day she never said that. But my whole proposal was based on that.
Have you told them your proposal? Have you told them the phrasing? Because that you guys are like a match made in heaven, if that's what she said.
It was sheer poetry.
It was perfect.
Sheer poetry.
It was playful.
Yeah, she never recognized my proposal as a proposal either. Yeah. It was, okay. It's not the case that I don't like you. I thought that
right
was
there.
Perfectly
That's
clear.
And list, he's and saying can... women don't say what they mean.
At my house,
that's clear.
Everyone's told me Jessica will say that too. Because yeah, we know you. We know how Jessica's not the case that I like you.
All right, I have a question. Well, let me describe the circumstance first. All in high school before high school, 5 years, maybe 4 years, I don't remember, I was infatuated with one girl. And for me...
Starting the second grade?
I might as well have. I think it probably would have lasted that long as well. She made it pretty clear that she wasn't interested, so it should have been cut and bang, like, end. But... The feelings didn't really go away, and I started to hate the feelings. Like, I went insane. I'm just like, how dare you still be in my mind? And then it got to the point where whenever it's here, I get like this adrenaline shot of like nervousness, and my brain would just like freeze over. Like, I would literally feel the hair in the back of my neck just go whoosh. So, whoosh. So I was... I kind of thought about it for a while, and I forced myself to admit maybe I was in love with the idea of being in love with her. Kind of like I was in love with the idea of the girl, not the girl herself. Because after she like cut me off, like we didn't talk that much, and when we did, like I froze. And I was not very good at making conversation. I once actually made up my own language like on the spot, and I was dead scared. Like I seriously don't remember. Like she asked me, like, how are you doing? I answered, it was horrible. I was so petrified. So, my question is, what's a good way to counter infatuation? How do you stop the drug? Because I guess it's a drug, it's addictive. So how do you, like, stop it from, how do you stop shooting up? Like,
Watch them pick their nose.
she tried...
But you made a very profound point, is that with infatuation, you're really never in love with the real person. It's always, to a certain extent, an imaginary phantom of who they actually are. And that, I think that's just sort of the nature of the phenomenon, that you are in love with... I mean, oftentimes it begins, the person is a complete stranger to you. You can't possibly be in love with a real person. You don't even know them. You know, you saw them across the room once. So that's true, and there is some truth to the fact that when reality comes crashing in, that can create a kind of weight that does do away with the drug. But I think you're describing something else, and that is that desire that we have to keep it alive, and there, to a certain extent, we can stoke it, kind of keep it coming, and I think we do that by romantic fantasy. At least that was true for me, that where you, I don't mean sexual fantasy, I mean a romantic fantasy, that where you are thinking about how wonderful the person is and how noble the person is and so on and so forth, and you just keep feeding yourself that image of the person. You construct that image of the one that you're in love with. And that can have a tendency to prolong it. So the only thing I know to do is cut that out.
Stop daydreaming.
Yeah,
and also just recognize that this is an imaginary person that I'm infatuated with, not a real person. And this could address Julian's question also. How do I find out who the real person is? I give it time from a distance. Lots of time, lots of distance.
And don't do romantic things together. Do real life together. Like picking people's noses? As a service? Okay, one more. Let me...
Julian, I still love you. Even though I know you so well. I guess I was going to ask about, you were talking about getting hit with the Cupid arrow. Once you've been hit, does that particular Cupid die and you're never hit again? Or what happens if you get hit again?
By that Cupid or another Cupid?
By another one.
Well, help me what it would understand for that Cupid to die.
What I mean is, once you've been hit with that arrow, with Eros, what happens if it happens again after you've already made...
With the same person?
With a different person.
Oh, okay.
After you've already made a commitment going on all the, you know, feelings and respect and whatever from the Eros that you received, and it happens again. Can it happen again?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
It can happen. It can happen to people that are married after they're married with someone else.
Right. That's what. That...
You know, just some stranger comes into your life, and wham, you just feel incredibly intrigued by this person, and that can get really dangerous if we don't have our heads screwed on straight about what marriage is and how insubstantial infatuation is. That can get really dangerous. And that in that case, what you need to tell yourself is, this is just a drug, and it doesn't mean nothing, and there's nothing to do about it. Just let it pass, let it go away.
So in that case, would the only reason for not pursuing that Eros be because I've already made a commitment? I guess what I'm getting at is...
That's not good enough?
How do I know that was the right one?
Because you promised him.
Right, but...
Well, what kind of commitment do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about, like, marriage.
Okay.
And then within marriage, you know, you're hit again. And, you know, I can just imagine myself being there and saying, okay, the only reason why I'm not reacting to this Eros that I've been hit with again is because I made a commitment. And does that mean that maybe I made that commitment too hastily? Maybe that wasn't the Eros that I was supposed to pursue. Like, this is the... If that's the only thing that I have, you know, that can be really difficult.
That's part of what I meant by saying that marriage is not based on Eros. If you did it right,
okay,
the first time, you didn't marry them because you were in love with them. You married them because you wanted to spend the rest of your life with them and only them and nobody else. If that was your commitment, then we have no business looking elsewhere, even if we do get hit by Cupid's arrow. If we made a mistake, mm-hmm, and we did base it on Eros the first time, we still made a promise. Mm-hmm. And it's keeping that promise that is what's testing our soul. You know, what am I made of? What's my character here?
So you would say that there's only one person out there that you would have a desire to spend the rest of your life with?
I also think that's a part of the mythology that we're so accustomed to. is that God put us in the world and said, now, go find the right one. And I don't think that's true. The right person is the person that I decided to commit my entire life to. Mm. That is the right person for me.
Okay.
Part of the seduction of the Eros is the foot in the door. There's something better.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, right? Okay, we've kept you over. We'll pursue a lot more of these questions in the upcoming weeks. Thank you for being so patient.